clarified and corrected before we move on. But once again, we welcome. Before we actually start the meeting, I would like to take a brief minute to
have a moment of silence, just because our community, the firefighting community, has been pretty severely impacted with a lot of members battling COVID. We've even lost a few members in the state, as well as a lot of family members of firefighters. So in addition to that, there's two other people I'd like to just have y'all keep in our prayers. Commissioner Tommy Anderson has been in the hospital for several weeks and will be for several weeks more. And Aaron Donahue is a firefighter in the Irving Fire Department, was struck up on the highway the other night, especially from a department such as Irving that's been pretty much the pioneers of developing the blocker program. And last month, I know a lot of you that are listening and a lot of you that are here today heard from a family that from the panhandle of the loss of their son, and how passionate they are about us trying to do everything we can to keep our firefighters safe up on the limited access freeways and interstates. So if you would, just a brief moment of silence for these people for us today. Okay, Chief Schmidt, if you would start us off with our agenda.
Yes, sir. Presiding Officer Daniel DeYeer.
Here.
I'm sorry. Roll call and excuses of committee members' absences. Daniel DeYeer.
Here.
Daniel Buford, Assisting Presiding Officer.
Here.
Vince Abrego.
Present.
Daniel Anderson.
Here.
Jason Collier.
Present.
Jim Reedy.
Here.
Ken Swindell.
Here.
And Keith Schmitz here as well. Item number two.
Well, let's, if you would, everybody, just because we have so many folks that are listening in and tuning in through Facebook and the internet, if y'all would introduce yourself, please, as we go around the room, so everybody knows who's here. Go ahead, Jason, I'll let you start.
I'm Jason Collier, Assistant Fire Chief with the Highland Village Fire Department. I oversee the support services for the department. I've been in the fire service for 35 years.
I'm Ken Swindell. I started in the fire service in 1975. I retired at Louisville Fire Department with 32 years. Presently the fire chief at Crum for 13 years. We're a combination fire department.
I'm Jim Reedy. I'm a lieutenant in the San Antonio Fire Department. I have just about 33 years on the job. I'm a ladder truck lieutenant, and I also sit on the NFPA 1971 and 1851 committees.
I'm Keith Schmidt. I've been in the fire service since 1979. I became fire chief for the Gonzales Fire Department in 2009, county fire marshal in 2011, and at the young age of 55, went through cop school and recently a policeman. So still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up.
My name's Daniel DeYeer. I'm a deputy chief of the training division for the Dallas Fire Rescue Department, and I entered the fire service in 1978.
Daniel Buford. I'm a chauffeur for the Bryan Fire Department since 2008. I've been in the fire service, since 2013 for 8 years, and been in the fire service since 2007.
Vince Abrego, McAllen Fire Department. Been with McAllen for about 27 years, a lieutenant on Rescue 1. There for the city of McAllen. Thank you.
Daniel Anderson, I'm a lieutenant with the Dumas Fire Department. We're about 46 miles north of Amarillo. I've been there. November 7th was 15 years full-time, about 2.5 years before that as a volunteer.
Okay, thank you.
Item number two, adoption of September 17, 2020, Firefighter Advisory Committee meeting minutes.
Motion to accept.
Second.
Buford seconded. Reedy made the motion. Sorry. All those in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed?
Item number three, report from the Curriculum and Testing Committee regarding possible changes to the Fire Investigator Curriculum Manual, reference list, and outline.
Mr. Chairman, Certification Manager Cliff Grant is going to give you this presentation.
Can you guys hear me?
I can, but I'm...
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, my name's Cliff Grant. I'm the certification manager here at the Texas Commission on Fire Protection. Also present here today is George, and George is on the ad hoc committee for investigator. So if you guys have any questions, other than what, if I cannot answer, you can answer the questions for the ad hoc committee. These are the changes that are going through because of the increase in hours to the investigator certification and investigator curriculum. It is going from 160 hours to 200 hours, so they're increasing the time in class up to 200 hours. I will tell you, the state of Texas is one of the lowest for investigators. The state of California requests 340 hours.
Florida's 340.
Or Florida's 340, and California is...
270.
270. So we're just now getting to the $200 mark. There is also statewide support from stakeholders, different stakeholders, for the increase in hours for this. So as you guys go through the curriculum stuff, you can see some of the, you can see the changes to the present curriculum, but the changes that they want to make to increase the hours. And on the hours page, some of the stuff is actually decreased in hours, but it's picked up in other sections of the curriculum.
So did we get any feedback, pushback, negative feedback on the increase in the hours?
No, sir. TCFP has not received any negative feedback in the hours, and I don't think the ad hoc committee has received any negative feedback. The only thing they've got is supporting the increase in hours.
We sent out emails and phone calls to the 8 professional organizations around the state, East Texas, North Texas, Tarrant County, West Texas, Kidder, Houston, Central Texas, and South Texas. The ones that responded to everything was, I was never able to get in touch with anybody from South Texas. They never responded back to me. But everyone I talked to was supportive.
And the increase is based on JPRs?
The increase is based on the requisite knowledge material that backs up the JPRs. The JPRs and NFPA 1033 really have not changed since 1993 at the issuance of 1033. But the requisite knowledge that based to the JPRs has. I went to the investigator class in 2004, used the 2001 edition, less than 200 pages. The edition that just came out in August, over 400 pages. So we're not trying to even double our hours, but our material is doubled.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, motion to accept.
I want to ask one question for, I mean, what, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
How many hours is this, I know I saw it in here, but how many hours are put in for building construction? I think they have it under building systems, if I remember right.
Two.
Is it building construction?
Building systems for hours for us is two.
2 hours.
2 hours.
And in order for them to get the actual certificate or to get that rating, they have to have been a basic firefighter.
For the 2 hours?
No. Before they ever take this class.
No.
They don't have to. No. So they only have to have 2 hours of building construction to do the arson investigation. Okay.
Correct.
That's what I was afraid of. Okay.
All right, so I do have a motion.
I'll second it.
Jason Collier seconded it. Any further discussion? All those approved?
Aye.
Aye.
Any disapproved? Motion passed.
Item number 4, proposed amendments to 37 Texas Administrative Code Part 13, Chapter 421, Standards for Certification.
Mr. Chairman, it's a minor change due to a state law change. You'll find it on page 136, the last page of Section 421 in your book. And it is the requirement of the Texas Education Code regarding license renewal and default on student loans. during the last legislative session, they changed that law, so we're just catching up.
Didn't they, wasn't that the change that you could, we couldn't do that anymore?
Yeah, we can't, yeah, they changed the state law, so we have to update the rules.
I'll make a motion for approval.
Second.
All right, have a motion and a second. Any additional discussion? No questions or comments? All those approved?
Aye.
Any that disapprove? Motion passed.
Item number five, proposed amendments to 37 Texas Administrative Code, Part 13, Chapter 429, Fire Inspector and Plan Examiner, Subchapter B, Minimum Standards for Plans Examiner, 429.201, Minimum Standard for Plan Examiner Personnel.
Mr. Chairman, you'll see the structure language on page 138. This is removing the special provision that was put in place after we broke out Plans Examiner from Inspector. And this gave them a year to get certified if they didn't already hold it.
Have you heard any requests for extension of that at all?
From anybody? We haven't received any. In fact, I don't think in the last 6 months we've even had anybody try to apply. So as it was dwindling down, I think everybody jumped on it pretty fast.
Right. Okay.
Make a motion to approve the removal of the, call it the grandfather clause.
I'll second it.
I have a motion and a second. Do I have any discussion? Questions or comments? All those approved?
Aye.
Aye. Any disapproval? Motion passed.
Item number six, proposed amendments to 37 Texas Administrative Code, Part 13, Chapter 435, Firefighter Safety.
Mr. Chairman, this change originated as a request from the staff. A couple of years ago, the language was added in there that the annual submission of the PPE SOP would be required. A couple of things have happened since then, and one huge hurdle that we're looking for a little help with. But most importantly, the compliance guys are seeing very consistent compliance now with or a great deal of effort towards compliance with 1851 and the departments that had struggled in the past. What we're finding is we're getting bogged down every year, spending a lot of time reading these SOPs, and we're seeing them regularly. We're getting the same ones submitted that they hand them when they do their inspection. And even more importantly, we're having a huge electronic storage problem. So based on the fact that we're seeing an improvement, I think it served its purpose at the time, but I think we would be safe in removing that annual requirement because it still holds in the language that we can ask for it at any time. So if we go in for an inspection or if we get a complaint, we can ask for it. They're going to have to submit it to us.
Chief, I got a question. On those annual submission of those SOPs, do we have a percentage of the departments that submitted those in regards to, and also those that did not? In other words, if they were required on an annual basis, there's still some departments out there that have not submitted anything at all?
I'll let Paul speak to that, but I think we had pretty good compliance with them. Well, we wrote them pretty hard.
Paul, I've been out of compliance manager. Departments submitted the required SOP.
All submitted. Because if they didn't, they were not compliant. So everyone submitted. Now, the review of them, there needed to be some corrections and some improvements on it. But everybody submitted an SOP. All regulated fire departments that were required to submit.
Okay, thank you.
So do you have an idea of percentage, ballpark, of how many were not compliant that submitted?
No, I do not have an exact percentage.
Ballpark it. I mean,
probably half. Probably half of them needed to make improvements.
Half of the SOPs that were submitted were not compliant with the
statute. Yeah, and when we first started doing this, but now we're not seeing that. So, I mean, there's been progress there. I think it was a successful requirement, but I think it's kind of outlived it. And the bigger issue is we just can't store all this stuff electronically. It's just, it's too much for the system.
Is this, to follow up with what Jim's question is, and I know I was one of those departments that submitted it and then got kicked back and had to resubmit it for approval, which we did. Is this something, though, to look at the change of 1851? Because that was where, next to the update, to kind of look back at that, because that's where we got caught was when
sure.
they updated
yeah,
this last one.
I think from an agency standpoint, we're going to have to do a much better job. As we know NFPA changes are coming, we're going to have to get that out there and work with departments to be able to plan for that, prepare for it, and update. And I think the compliance guys are doing a great job now of being proactive with their departments and working with them and helping them throughout the year, not just when they walk in to do an inspection. So.
I'll have to give credit to Paul and his group with my compliance officer. He was very helpful and kind of walked us through what we need to add to it. So, I mean, that wasn't the issue. I just want to make sure, kind of falling back to where Jim's at, that, you know, another couple of years when 1851 comes back out and redoes it, that the compliance officers go back and request to look at those again to make sure that we are staying, that the departments in the state are staying current with the current NFPA standard.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's a no-brainer. I mean, they're doing really well. This is one of those SOPs they're going to ask for every time they do an inspection. So, and again, if we ever have a concern or a complaint or something on somebody, we're going to be able to ask for it right then.
Do you foresee the inspections going to maybe half and half, where you have the guys who are actually sending us information and saying, please send all this stuff into us, and then we're going to come out and do the inspection? It cut their time down as far as in the field having to be out there.
Without getting too far off the agenda item here, I think because of the COVID, we had to make some adjustments mm-hmm. in the way we're doing our compliance inspections. I think we've had a lot of success. Where that goes is going to be something we're going to discuss with the commissioners probably at their next meeting. But everyone's been very receptive, and it's probably reduced the amount of time the inspectors are spending on looking at SOPs, because they've been able to get them a week or two in advance, have a chance to read through it, catch what might need to be corrected, and start working with them before they actually show up and put their hands on the PPE and stuff. So the hands-on, one-on-one contact with the compliance guy being in the fire stations, by design, we reduce that amount of time to protect everybody involved. But I think we've seen really the efficiency of that whole process improve a little bit. And that, Paul, I'll let you speak to it if you want. I mean, it's your...
All the department, it seems like, I mean, I don't have specific data, but mostly all the departments like the process that we're using. We notify in advance by email to let them know that we need to receive these documents, and we'll list all the documents that we need to receive. And so then the compliance officer has time to review the information before they go to the site to visit. And so all the fire departments like that, because we do a much better job of review and then a better job of communicating after we've done the review. All departments have said they like it. The compliance officers say they like it. I believe we're doing a better quality inspection in that way, because we get more time to review all the documentation rather than go on the scene, I mean, at the fire department, and then review it real quickly or maybe not even have it available when we get there. So the process has received a lot of good feedback.
Seemed like, I mean, I was really amazed that they, as many SOPs as they're having thrown at them, that they're getting them out at all, honestly, because that's a ton for those guys have to deal with and read. But I know ours, I was lucky we didn't have a lot of problems, because we tried to stay up with it year to year. But he was quick, our guy was real quick in getting everything back to us and getting us informed. So I didn't know how everybody else was going along, but it would seem repetitious after this year to continue with the people that are, that are within guidelines, that would be one less you could check off, that those unless you're adding something new that we haven't had, PPE, SCBA, something like that, that would require something new because the guidelines possibly have changed with NFPA or something. But I was wondering about you checking people off, saying, well, I don't even need to see this for a couple of years or 3 years, 4 years, because you were in compliance and you've got everything what we need. Now I'll go work on the ones that really need the help trying to get it done. Just a thought.
Sure. It's worth considering, but we got to maintain some kind of element of surprise there. You don't know what we're going to ask to see when we walk in.
It messes up my lunch every time.
I do know from, and I agree with Chief Swindle that, and we got part of that. Well, we sent them in, got it back. And I know we got a little notice, ahead of notice, but there's not enough time to correct. If you're not in compliance or 98% in compliance, the 4 or 5 days extra notice that we're getting, which I really enjoyed, appreciated, isn't enough to correct everything that if you're not there.
And absolutely. And I think we knew going into this wasn't going to – this doesn't put an end to us going in and finding problems. We're still finding issues. I mean, they find discrepancies. And I think what we are seeing when they do physically walk in and they can put their hands on gear, they're actually able to spend more time. It probably –
I agree.
Without even planning it, do a much more thorough inspection of the PPE, and they're still finding issues, but it's not so much. They're not rushing through the first half of their inspection, trying to read all this, because look, none of us can sit there and read a 14-page SOP and know that everything's right. So by them getting that ahead of time and working back and forth, that opens up that visit, that one-on-one visit, to focus more on looking at the equipment, and I think. The guys have reported that they feel like they're getting more done, and the departments are saying that they feel like it's been better. The biggest, I guess, compliment I've gotten is that the smaller departments are able to have those key players there. I mean, everybody, you know, they might have a captain or a lieutenant that takes care of SCBAs or PPE or something, and because they get a little bit of notice, they can call this individual and say, hey, I either – need you here this week, or I need all the information you've got if you're not going to be available, so that we can answer the questions. And what the compliance guys tell us is this has saved them, because they walk in prior to this, the guy's not there, there's no way I can get this stuff, I'll have it by Friday, can you come back? It bogged down the whole process. So, you know, I got to tell you, we didn't do any inspections for almost nine weeks when the COVID first hit. I think they're back on schedule. We're not at the end of the year yet. So we actually were able to step up. I mean, that 9 weeks was made up once we got back in late June going. So we've seen some progress from it. Where it goes from here, I don't know. That'll have to be a conversation with the commissioners.
I agree with you. My inspector, he actually spent more time looking, because he didn't have to do the paper review part side of it. He spent more time looking through the gear and the SCBAs, and
right.
So it wasn't rushed.
And I agree with your comment. There's no way to fix everything that's wrong. And what every fire chief has is firefighters. And if they feel like they're being hustled or not treated the right way, they're going to let us know. Yeah. I mean, the complaints we do get don't come from other fire chiefs on somebody. They come from the firefighters. So there's no concern in my mind that's going to end. If they see something going on that they don't think is above board, we're going to know about it. And so
getting back to the compliant SOP part, so how do we ensure that a fire department has a compliant SOP, especially in the lag time between inspections if a standard changes? So if
there's a little bit of trust there. These guys are running organizations that are responsible for people. But if there's a complaint or a concern, we can go ahead and ask for it. I mean, that's it, and they're going to have to be able to produce it.
I believe that's answered in the document.
What's that?
I believe they answered his questions. Answered right there where we're changing number 4 to B.
Yeah.
It clearly states that it needs to be reviewed and revised as needed and needs to stay compliant with NFPA 1851. Yeah. it's clearly already in there. So if the standard changes 2 years from now, obviously, everybody needs to follow suit.
Yeah, and like I said earlier, I think we're going to have to do a better job as an agency pushing that out sooner. There's a change coming. I mean, we all know, we knew 1851 was about to change when it did. I'm not saying there wasn't a good job of pushing that out, but we're gonna put forth an extreme effort this next time to get it out there and do that. So, I mean, there's got to be some trust in there. We can't stand over them every single day, but the opportunity is there. We can look at it anytime we want. So.
And so, just as a side note, these numbers, they're going to change. There's a consolidation going on in NFPA to bring a lot of the standards together, probably to cut NFPA's cost down. So these numbers are going to change. The actual part of it, it's an NFPA document, but these numbers are going to change. So, and we're going to have to, it's going to be tough.
Well, that'll be good. We need to have a more robust rule review process anyway, so that'll help.
Well, I think, you know, the big deal for us was, and it may have been, I heard from a lot of other guys, a lot of the chiefs from other departments, you know, when they came out with the line item of one page and it went to 10 pages is what we were looking at, and the risk assessment became SEBA risk assessment was on there, but it wasn't on there. Not for me, it wasn't on there. It was on there, but I didn't know it was on there. Mm-hmm. Not y'all's fault. But I didn't see it. So trying to catch up with that 10-page last year or year before was one of the big hurdles that everybody was going crazy over because they thought, oh my gosh, I got all this stuff. I'm fixing to be non-compliant. I got to get this stuff done, blah, blah, blah. And so everybody's calling everybody and nobody knew which direction to go. So as those things were added in, and I think everybody learned a lesson off of that to, you know, either, you know, have a little bit of forethought of how we approach that instead of throwing it out there because everybody thought, oh my gosh, I got to be compliant right now. And it wasn't so much you had to be compliant right that second, but you needed to make sure that you were taking, you know, all the future needs, you know, as an assessment. So
I think that fell in the category of change, and we all know how firemen are about change. You know, they hate change and they really hate the way things are now. We brought up the idea this year actually of going back to the one page, and you know, just like fire chief, you have your same individuals you hear from or see all the time in your office. The fire chiefs and the individuals that we hear from commonly all said, hey, we love this thing. Now that we understand it and we've been able to embrace it, it's helpful, it's good, we like it, we don't want to change it, but we left it alone. I think it was just that sale portion.
Shock.
You know? So, yeah, the shock of what the hell is this.
So anyway. The other thing is, as I look at this, we're talking about having to provide this particular SOP at the biannual inspection. I'm wondering if that should be noted in there, that maintain, provide to the commission at the biannual inspection or upon request. Maybe that might clarify it a little bit and at least give them some notice that at least every 2 years they're going to have to update their SOPs or at least look at them. Because I am sure that the majority of these departments didn't look at their SOPs until the last 2 or 3 weeks before the due date was. Because I know a place that happens at. So that's just a suggestion on my part. But anything that we can do to identify and at least put them on notice that they're going to have to provide this may help, I would think.
Just I've a got comment. A question for Paul. Have you got any feedback from the compliance officers? I do know that you're saying that all the departments submitted SOPs to where they go into a department and the SOPs that were submitted, the department is truly not complying with that SOP for whatever reason. Have you got any feedback from that, and do they see a lot of that when they do the compliance inspections where the SOP is not truly being followed from any particular departments?
We've had complaints, and then we go out and review the actual activities that the department is doing, And then we have, we've identified where, on occasion, they haven't been compliant with their own policy, and we notify them that they're not, and then they make the changes and the corrections. So it does happen. We don't, it doesn't happen often and a lot in comparison to the number of departments that we review their policies, but it does happen.
And we still have the at-risk inspection option, and I think without getting too deep in that, we've got a few departments that fit that, and so they're visited annually because there's been problems that have persisted in the past. So, but out of 750 or so inspections every year, those numbers are kind of minimal, but I think they do find exceptions where sometimes there's an issue and they have to get that corrected. But that's noted in their inspection reports too, so.
Chief, we're one of the, obviously the smaller of the departments, and we're probably halfway through the inspection with Mr. Gardner, and so far our experience has been, to your point, it's been much better. And that gives us the little bit of notice to go ahead and make sure we've got everything together, ready for him, sending it back to him. We don't have just one person that does it, obviously, you know, I'm volunteer, so it's a mixed bag. So having those capabilities and send it off to him, so instead of him just showing up and expecting us to have all that stuff, you know what I mean, ready for him or the right people there to help with questions or concerns is much harder for us. So far this process we like.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, the process came about because of the pandemic. It's had some, I think, some unanticipated, I'll say repercussions, advantages maybe. You know, the larger departments, I know a couple of them were able to, in the process of protecting everybody involved, set up a single location that the inspectors were, and the companies had to rotate through with their equipment, and they did it right there so that we could also see that it was getting fixed. I mean, they did it close by with their quartermaster or wherever that was set up so that if there was a problem, it got noted and they got sent over there to get it corrected, replaced, whatever they needed to do, and then brought it back to ensure that our guys saw that it was corrected. So there's been some benefits to it. Like I say, it was a kind of a must-do thing, but now we'll see where we're going to go with this.
So, Deb, do I already have a motion?
No. I'll make a motion for approval.
I have a motion to approve.
Second.
Chief Swindle, second. Any additional comments? Questions? With no further discussion, I'll take a vote. All those that approve?
Aye.
Aye.
Does any disapprove? Motion passed.
Item number 7. Proposed amendments to 37 Texas Administrative Code, Part 13, Chapter 445, Administrative Inspections and Penalties.
Mr. Chairman, I got to start this with a little bit of a story just to catch everybody up so you know what we're doing here. Previous sunset process, they recommended some stronger language in the penalties and administrative inspections section, and that was done. Somewhere around 2014, 2015, there was a legal opinion that was no longer needed because of some changes in some other state codes. And so there was a blanket removal of a lot of language that I think we all felt was necessary to have in there, but it was removed. As this current sunset process was approaching, there was a lot of concern that was the one thing hanging out there that hadn't been corrected from the last one, and that, you know, they were going to get us on this. We even went so far as to have a conversation with Sunset about it. We got some legal opinions on it, and what you're seeing today is essentially we're putting back the language that was originally put in there back in 2010 or 11 to correct that problem, and was what we're saying inadvertently removed in 14 or 15. We've added it back in there, and that seems to make everybody a little more comfortable with it. Sunset was good with it. They understood the reason for the removal of it, but they agreed with our effort to try to clean that up. So what you're seeing here, while it is new language to the rule, it's the language that was removed. So we're recycling it, we're plugging it back in. So that's what you're seeing today. We're trying to correct an accidental removal, if you will, a few years back. So with that, now I'll leave it to you guys, but I just wanted to kind of lay that out to you.
Okay, and you and your compliance team feel like this would help?
Yeah, so the compliance guys, we spent a lot of time working on this. If you'll remember, about a year and a half ago, it was brought to the commission a big matrix, penalty matrix and all. And it was received about as well as the 10-page inspection guide thing, kind of caused some heartburn and set off a few alarms. In looking back at what was in there and talking with Sunset about what their intention was in 09, we felt that the language did a really good job of covering that. So in talking with the compliance guys, everybody seemed to believe this would satisfy what they were looking for. And it certainly provides the guidance that's needed. What you're not going to see is some big matrix of penalties and all that, but that information's available. That really serves more as a guide to us here as a staff when we get to that point, how to use that. But this new language really lays out for everybody to understand the process and how we're going to come to a determination.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of questions for whoever's going to take them. That's okay. In 445.7, there's references to the inspector's opinion, and then how is that going to be quantified or qualified in a case of major injury or an injury or a major illness that's caused by noncompliance? So an immediate injury or an immediate illness that's caused by noncompliance, how is that going to be quantified? And everybody's opinions typically may be the same. We've had that experience over the years here with some of the previous compliance officers. So my fear is that opinion qualifier may be different from one compliance officer to the next. And how do we get over that?
So let me clarify, you're speaking of major violations, right? I mean, the ones that cause injuries or?
Well, even in the minor violations in B1, it says minor violations shall be defined as those violations when the inspector determines do not pose a serious threat. It's still, ostensibly, it seems like his opinion. And then in 2, yes, it talks about the inspector's opinion for higher potential.
Isn't that already put in, though? I mean, don't they really have that lined out on the...
In the new language that you're being asked to give an opinion on today, 445.11 does outline or define what major violations, really where those start. To speak more to the minor ones or just the topic in general, I would say that unfortunately, in our society today, the opinion matters in all of this. I mean, all of this is based on interpretation and opinion, and every lawyer is going to have a different one. Every firehouse lawyer is going to have a different one. So I'm not sure that we could ever capture all of that. But I understand the point you're making. And I, having read through this pretty well, I think 11 tends to start clarifying that a little bit, because it gets into the ones where we're really see injuries that are significant, and we're trying to prevent them.
And so that's my concern. It's still the inspector determines that the department has committed a major violation. If all the compliance officers are on the same page and there's some kind of guidance or whatever that, you know, if this firefighter has an injury because, then something immediate needs to be done, that would be fine. I mean, but it just seems that there's a lot of, I don't know. It's
like when you have a set of an ensemble of PPE, an ensemble sent in, and you've got a safety-related and non-safety-related items. It's kind of cut and dry. I mean, isn't it?
Well, I'd like to think so, but...
I mean, when you send us, I know for us, when I send that stuff in, it's cut and dry. I get it back. This is a non-safety item, and I may not fix it, okay? But if it's a safety item, it's fixed every time.
Well...
So, I mean, I don't know. I'd like to think that, from that standpoint, they're not actually judge and jury on, they're saying this is cut and dry. I would think they have a, don't they have a checklist that they have to go by?
Do they have a checklist?
Paul?
We have checklist. I'm not exactly sure that the checklist that y'all, whatever y'all are thinking, specifically. I mean,
I think of things as black and white, Paul. I think of things as it either is or it isn't.
Or it isn't.
There's no gray area in there, okay? That's what I'm saying. A checklist of safety item, a non-safety item. On that same ensemble, I might fix three things, and two of the non-safety items don't get fixed.
Mm-hmm.
When they're at the
But they take a checklist with them, right?
We don't create new checklist. The rule, the standard that the rule adopts, that's what we use. Now we look at the standards and we have we pull out from those standards what the specifics are. And that's what we train on, and that's what we make sure that we're inspecting to the standard. So we don't create some new checklist or new documentation that we use.
And I think really that's what that inspection guide is.
It comes straight out of the standard.
That inspection guide outlines.
There's nothing in that 10-page inspection guide that we made up. That's you can track. That's what the purpose of it was. You can each line in that 10-page document. You can go straight back to a standard that is adopted by the rule.
So we're using that same 10-page guideline, just updated with the current standards. That's what the inspectors are using.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's why it was sent out.
That's what we train on. Yes.
What they're going to be held to.
That's what I train them on. That's what we train. That's what we review all the time. When an inspector goes and inspects something, and a question comes up, then we get together as a group and we look at what the inspector that has the question, what the facts are that they have discovered, and we apply it to the standard. We apply the facts to the standard. So it's never a personal opinion, and they always have to come through me when they're going to cite a violation that's out of the norm, out of the usual.
Okay. So My next question is then, what causes something to be taken out of service immediately?
Well, first of all, whenever we have asked a department to take something out of service, I can't think of a single time that any fire chief has objected. So we don't just ask that on a regular basis. And in fact, I don't think the rule says that we can require it to be taken out of service. But I've instructed them that, for example, if you have an SCBA that is clearly non-functional, something as obvious as a leaking hose, well, you ask them, that hose, we identified it's leaking, we need to take it out of service. And the chiefs normally agree. So it's always something that the fire chief agrees with, and the firefighter and the fire department. We've never ever had something where there is a difference of opinion about at that criticality of a violation, if you will.
So
and I think even deeper, Jim, if it doesn't meet the standard that's cited either in the rules or is so noted on that inspection guide, that's certainly going to warrant it being removed from service.
So if you have an item that is known as a major violation, and that particular item is, like you're saying, pulled off for service, what happens when on that clause there says a 30-day calendar date, the formal notice to correct the violation, what happens within that 30 days? That's not giving 30 days to replace that item, right? It stays on the rig to replace it, in other words, within that 30-day time frame. So in other words, there is a correction requirement of 30 days to correct a violation, but there are some violations that got to be corrected immediately, correct?
That was the question that I was responding to that Jim asked.
Okay, just wanted to clarify
yes, sir.
That.
Well, so that my follow-up was going to be about the 30-day thing, too. So for a major violation, having 30 days to cure that, I mean, if it's an issue like your bunker gear is not compliant and will not protect you, or your bunker gear is so dirty it could stand up in a corner by itself, or you know, your SCBA or whatever, the helmets don't work. I mean, that stuff should be taken out of service right away, and that problem should be cured right away, not in 30 days.
Is that, that's, I mean, I we're not in disagreement, but that's higher up. That's outside of them. If that comes to me, they tell me, like, I had a helmet. This helmet, we think, has a crack in it. I mean, true story. Okay, we need you to make sure that it's okay. And I said, okay, and you've got 30 days to I said, well, that helmet's out of service. It's right out of service right now. And so we send it in to our PPE people, and they come back and say, you need to replace it. Well, it was already taken out of service. It's already done.
Well, and I admire that you're conscientious like that.
No, I'm not saying that because that. That's what we're supposed to be doing. Well, but that's outside of, from them, all they can do is tell us this is not right. What we do, hey, man, I mean,
I don't agree with that. This is a regulatory agency that is supposed to oversee the safety of the firefighters of this state.
How can they tell you? How can they come and make sure? They got to take it with them, Jim.
It's non-compliant, and they need to direct them to take it out of service.
I guess I got a question. Are you telling me there's somewhere out there that you're aware of that is violating it?
So there's been past instances, yes.
Okay, but right now? I mean, is there something right now?
Not right now.
Because we'll go today.
I know.
I'll go with them. I don't think this exists, and I'll tell you that I don't think you can write a rule to cover every absolute circumstance that we can find.
I agree.
It's just like an SOP. You're a lieutenant on a ladder truck. They can't tell you every step of the day what you're going to have to do. You got to be able to make a decision. They got to trust you. We're going to have to trust the fire chiefs. I think our inspectors identify problems. If it's a major violation, it's corrected right there. The article's removed. And there's follow-up to ensure that it's removed, and there's a plan to fix it.
But that's fine.
Yeah.
There's follow-up right away. It's removed, and there's follow-up right away.
And it's documented. I mean, there's a difference in documentation.
We had to send a letter back in, Jim, telling them that what was said.
Yeah.
I mean.
So. But that's really the answer I'm looking for.
Yeah.
It's taken out of service, and there's follow-up right away.
And it's in the we're looking for it right now. But in 419, it speaks to. Major violation, a life safety issue, we have the authority to have it removed from service right then. So it's in 419.043. Thank you, Deb. Mm-hmm. When it talks about the applicable NFPA standards. Let's see here. The agency may continue to use an item that's was in use or contracted before. We know that. If it constitutes an undue risk to the wearer, in which case the commission shall order the use be discontinued and shall set an appropriate date for compliance with the revised standard. So right there, if it creates an undue risk, our guys are going to tell them you got to remove this, and we're covered by the law.
I would almost think that should be restated in this particular.
I'm not sure that it's not. Okay. I think the farther down into this you get, I think it's pretty clear.
So this really,
and it is stated in 435, because the language in 435 is almost verbatim out of 419, which creates a whole another buttload of problems for us. It shouldn't be that way, but whatever, it is, and so it's verbatim in the rule.
You got any more questions? I got a couple.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead, Chief.
No.
Do you have another?
No, I'm just wondering on 445.1C on the very first page, it talks about shall include inspections of volunteer firefighters and fire departments. Do you have a bunch of volunteer fire departments that have given you okay to come into their department to do inspection?
I don't know if there's a bunch, but we continue to get a few more every year that voluntarily comply.
That's good.
And realize that that's in the rule right now. It's already there. We're not talking about changing it.
It's supposed to be duplication, but it's not.
I don't know the exact numbers, but there are several volunteer fire departments across the state that voluntarily came to us and requested to be regulated by us because they want to meet the standards at their department, even as a volunteer service.
Good.
At a meeting yesterday, I had a volunteer chief come up and ask what he needed to do to become compliant. So I told him
how to talk to him.
And we could help him. We could help him do that.
Nice.
We're always looking to do more.
And I know this is going to really rile some people up, but I got to ask anyway. 445.9 under 2, the very last sentence says lack of funds is not an acceptable reason for delay.
Right.
Do they set a plan up for those guys that can't, some of these departments that might get in a catch 22 situation?
So again, this has been in the rule since 91 that I know of, and that's part of that.
That's why 30 I'm
days
asking,
you, that part of that 30 days you got to submit a plan how you're going to do this. They have to document how a course of action,
what happens
how they're going to correct
at the end of the 30 days. I'm just asking, what happens if they can't fulfill that obligation?
No, you're misunderstanding what I'm saying. They have 30 days after it is identified at the inspection to give us a document that outlines their plan to address that.
Gotcha.
Okay. Doesn't have to be
based on what that plan
days.
Tells us.
Right.
That's how much time they have, and we interact with them until it is corrected.
So you, but the time frame is.
It's not up to us.
Okay. All right. Just asking. I'd seen it there before. The law
stops short of saying we manage your fire department. You have to manage your fire department.
Gotcha.
But you are looking for an acceptable corrective action.
And if they give us a plan of action, the compliance guys, they make a note of it, and they check back in with them. In the last 2 weeks, it's happened 3 times. I know me and Paul have talked about a couple. Me and Cliff are working on it right now where it was a follow-up. The compliance guy went in 3 months in advance of the deadline for that action to occur. And now we're deeply engaged with that organization, making sure they get everything done. So I think the compliance guys do a pretty good job of staying on top of it. Do things fall through the crack? Yeah. I mean, I think that happens to all of us, but for the most part. I think they've been wearing me out for the last 10 months. They brought me some pretty heated topics to deal with in the last few months. And we've been able to work through it, but it's been brought from the compliance guys, not from complaints.
Well, to piggyback on that, the major violations have time frames.
Yeah.
So those are mandatory cure times.
Right.
So, good.
Okay, we don't have a motion, though, do we?
I'll make a motion to approve.
Second.
Chief Collier and Chief Swindle, motion and seconded. Any additional comments?
I think the compliance section here is really doing a good job, and they've really stepped up their game in the last year. And I, all credit to them, but, I mean, don't take any offense to what we're asking, because this is the one of the most important parts for the firefighters is their line of last resort is those compliance inspections and the ability to have those problems cured. So. And credit to Paul and all the rest of the compliance people, they're doing a really good job. So, thanks.
And I agree with you. And I think to some extent, we can only fix what we know about, too. So, I mean, we somebody has a problem, we need to get a complaint so we can address it.
So start complaining.
No.
When did you stop?
We're not going to know about it unless we hear about it. So.
Okay, so I have a motion and a second. No additional comments, questions? All those that approve?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any disapprove? Motion passed.
Item 8, public comments.
So, Deb, do we have the ability for anybody that's on line or Facebook, they're not allowed to comment from the peanut gallery? Okay. Anybody here that's present?
I want to say something. I was here. This is Jim Reedy. I was here at the last commission meeting, and there was a room full of chiefs here complaining about how they couldn't be involved, and they weren't represented, and they were being, you know, left out of everything. And yet, none of them or any of their representatives are here. And obviously, we had a discussion about penalties that are implemented on fire departments for noncompliance and an SLP. And yet, I'm amused that nobody decided to show up and participate of that whole big group that was here saying how they weren't allowed to participate. So, thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I guess I'll take advantage of piggybacking on that. I think it's positive that they were, in fact, here, though. That was the first time that we've seen the room packed full of folks in quite some time. So I'm hoping that a lot of them are tuned in right now or listening through the internet or Facebook, or they'll at least play the tape back at a later date and listen to what's going on to the meeting. But as somebody who's been playing by the rules of TCFP for four decades now and serving on this committee for more than a decade of that period of time, I'll piggyback. There's been a lot of changes in this organization in the last year, and they're all been positive. I've seen a lot of good things coming. And like you say, we packed this room full of chiefs from the Dallas metro area last month, and I'm hopeful because I've been representing that area of the state for quite some time, and in 13 years, other than Chief Kistner from the McKinney Fire Department, I have never heard a word from any of those fire chiefs or fire departments on any issues ever pertaining to this committee, including their predecessors. And every one of them know my name and how to get a hold of me. But I still take that as a positive experience that they're showing some passion and compassion. We need to listen to what they're saying, and I believe we are. I believe everybody that's a stakeholder is aware that they were here last month and did make a statement. And to piggyback on what you're saying, Jim, I hope to see it in the future. Hopefully with COVID and the holiday season upon us, and maybe that's the reason we don't have them here today, but if you're listening, we're here, we're listening as well. So don't hesitate to reach out to us on any issues that you feel passionate about or any changes that you see that need to be made or don't like being made. You do need to voice your opinion. It makes this committee a whole lot easier when we're hearing what everybody thinks about what we're doing. And unfortunately, 9 out of 10 issues, it's crickets, and we just have to basically go on what we believe and what we think and what it impacts in our own organizations, which in my opinion could be a bad thing. But to the credit of every one of you, and I know every one of the members that's sitting up here on this committee, I will commend you all for your moral compass, constantly being focused on doing what's best for the firefighters and the safety and health and well-being of them, as well as the organizations we represent. I've not ever seen anybody on this committee ever doing anything that's self-serving for their own organization. It's clearly something that's best for the organization, for the Texas Fire Service. So, like I say, as well as everything's gone for the last year, there's been a lot of changes made, and I like the direction a lot of this stuff has been moving, and hopefully we'll continue moving forward when this pandemic's over. Maybe 2021 will bring us even future growth. I'm not high hopes on 2021 yet. I still want to see the terms and conditions before I agree, but I'll weigh in with an opinion. But I'll thank everybody that's on this committee, as well as staff and the commissioners. I think everybody's been doing a good job, trying the best they can. So once again, a heartfelt thank you to everybody.
Thank you.
Sir, can I say something?
Sure. Would you stand up at the mic so they can hear you on the internet?
Unless you're going to say something bad.
Yeah. Unless you're going to blow me out of the water now.
My name is Lance Beal, Fire Chief, City of Groves. I don't know if you gentlemen are the ones I need to talk to about it or not, but if you could pass this along to whoever needs to. I've been in fire service 23 years, taught 18 years at the LIP Regional Fire Academy. And several years ago, the curriculum was changed for the basic structure firefighter for the hazmat side for mission specific. You're breeding hybrid technicians with it. We're having to spend 21 days at a minimum teaching a kid or a new firefighter how to be a hazmat tech when we can't spend more time teaching a rookie firefighter how to be a true firefighter? We're spending one day to teach a kid how to pull hose or start a chainsaw or start a PPV, but we're spending 3 weeks teaching how to be a hazmat tech, or hybrid tech, I call it. So if we can get back to teaching the awareness and ops portion, because that's what a firefighter truly needs to be when he comes out of the fire academy and gets a first time on the job. If he wants to be a technician, he's got to get some years under his belt, and then he can get to be a technician. But we need to focus more on what they do as a primary job as a basic firefighter. Because I get chiefs all the time telling me, this guy come out of your academy and he's having trouble pulling hose, starting a chainsaw, or whatever. And I tell them the reason why, and they're like, that's freaking crazy. So I appreciate your time, appreciate what you gentlemen do for the fire service. I've always had a good experience with compliance officers and the commission. It's just I'd like to see if this could be addressed in a different way down the road. Thank you.
Okay, does anybody have any questions for the gentleman?
When we changed that, wasn't it because of the testing?
It was testing.
It was because of the testing.
Well, we didn't change the hours. No. We just changed the fact that they had to pass that part.
Yeah.
Right, but in order for us to get our guys to pass that hazmat portion, we had to extend to 21 days. Whenever it first came out, we weren't being able to have kids pass the test because there wasn't enough time in it. So we had to reduce time in other areas so that we could get those kids. We could just take that mission-specific portion out. It'd be a whole lot better.
But it was through the testing. What he was talking about, it changed, and what it changed in, we actually put more questions into the test. And then when we changed it into the test, Mike, is this not right? We changed the amount of questions asked in both of those areas, which would have, because the equation was not set up, they were putting, when they hit the button, they were getting like two questions for hazmat awareness or two questions for operations. And then when we changed it, that upped the amount of questions that we had available going into there. It was just basically to rearrange the ratio. So as far as, and I know exactly what you're talking about, because what we do is we have a packet. The guys have a packet that's passed around from guy to guy if we have any issue getting through those two testing portions of the state test. It's passed out to them, and they go back through that just to get through it. But as far as I can see, what's supposed to be taught in that class, there's nothing above that on the test questions. So I don't know, it's kind of crazy, because the same amount of possible questions have not changed. They're the same. There was just more added.
Well, so
I'll build on a little bit too, and I'll give you a little bit more information after the meeting's over. After everything changed January 1 of 2017, is which we went to, you had to pass all four sections to align with this set. We came back and ran the numbers. Nothing across the state number-wise in testing and fail rates has changed. The only portion that changed is we made the rule for the IFSAC correlation that you had to pass all four sections. The fail rate before that is the exact same as it is right now.
You're talking about after the fact?
After the fact.
After the fact.
After the fact. The pass and fail rate are exactly the same.
Gotcha.
But what I'm going to tell you is I'm going to give you some information about an individual you can contact that has made it a 180-degree turnaround at his after the January 1st, 2017 thing, that it's gone so good, major city fire departments have picked up his program and changed their training.
My it's not the testing. It's you have awareness and ops and mission-specific that you have to teach as far as the skills go. And the mission-specific skills are more advanced than the awareness and operations, what I'm meeting.
The JPR.
It's the JPRs, isn't it?
Yes, the JPR, it's the JPRs of the NFPA standard.
We don't write that, the NFPA does that.
Yeah, that's.
NFPA 1001.
I thought that was the case, but somebody else told me that it wasn't the case, and that's why I was asking.
No, it's just easy to throw off at the commission, so. No, I know.
Because I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand the test didn't change and all that.
Yeah.
They were telling me, I tried to tell them that the JPRs changed, and they said, no, it didn't. And there were a couple of other guys that backed him up on it. So we was, as instructors, were kind of upset that we were having to do this. And I didn't know if there was something we could do to kind of change that, because it's really what it is. We're putting out our best at.
Yeah, and like I said, after the meeting's over, I'll give you the contact information for the guy, and his program has made wonders in other training facilities, and it's teaching awareness operations, this is specific. And he doesn't do the whole three-week thing, because he's at a community college, it's structured, and after they started doing it, their failure rate for awareness and ops plummeted. Almost, no, I'm not going to say zero, but it got in the single-digit percentage of the classes that were doing it at the institute. And the one training facility for the major department that does it, they have had no awareness and operations failures since implementing that. The only thing that they have now is they may have one or two firefighter one or firefighter two failures, but they have not had any awareness and operations failures since they instituted that program.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any additional public comments? Anybody else in the room?
Okay. Item number 9, subjects for future agenda items.
I have a couple of quick questions for the executive director.
Oh, God.
If you will weigh in.
I'll have to get back to you on that.
One is asking for an update on the vacancy we have on our committee, on the advisory committee,
yes,
and then also
exists.
An update on Sunset.
Now, so the vacancy piece, the commissioners have narrowed the search to five individuals, and they're doing interviews during their workshop on January the 21st, which is a Thursday. So if I was a betting man, which I'm not, but I'd say probably for your next meeting, that vacancy will be filled.
Okay. So the January 22nd, is that the meeting?
That's the meeting that they'll
actually most
make
likely the confirmation or appointment?
Right.
Okay.
Second question was about the Sunset process.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So hopefully by now you all have seen the staff report that was released on the 20th. I need to explain the process so everybody knows it. Sunset is a three-step process. So step one is the staff review and supplemental report, which is what was just released, was the Sunset staff's report on their review of the agency. Step two has already begun. The Sunset Commission, which is a group of legislators, both House of Rep and senators, who receive the report, they review it, they receive any public input, they talk to those of us here with the agency, and then they'll have a second meeting where they'll address the report, they'll make any additional recommendations, make any requests for changes or whatever. They will most likely pass something related to the Commission Sunset report, send it on to the legislature for step three, which is where they will write legislation, a new 419, and pass it, and it has to be signed by the governor, and then September 1 goes into effect. All that said, we just started step two. We had a hearing on Monday with Sunset Commission. They received the report. There were a few questions back to the Sunset staff from some of the Sunset commissioners. So now we're in a public comment period for them. That public comment period ends on the 18th, which is next Friday. They'll receive those comments, and at a January 13th meeting, they'll discuss it at length. They'll either accept the report as is, or they'll add some recommendations, they'll expand on some of the existing recommendations, and then vote to send it to the legislature for adoption, or for a law, the creation of a law. in a nutshell, what the report said is that they want the agency to continue for another 12 years, and they made about 10 recommendations along the way. One substantial one that's going to require a lot of involvement by everybody here and the stakeholders is a different certification period. Right now we do it annually. Their recommendation was to go to at least a 2-year. There's even been discussion of a 4-year. So there'll have to be some discussion on what that looks like and how we move forward to accomplish that, if in fact that's included in whatever legislation gets drafted. Second, more hot button issue was about our committees. This committee, along with the other committees that the agency has, Sunset's opinion, the Sunset staff opinion, is that we're violating a different Texas government code about advisory committees, in that they said this committee specifically is outside of their date of allowable activity. We'll see how that gets addressed. If that continues as a recommendation, I think the commission will evaluate all their committees, probably do some rule development that defines each committee, their scope, the makeup, things like that. So I think you can anticipate discussion on that. And I see that probably beginning before the actual legislation is out of the House and the Senate. But Sunset recommends that we clean that up a little bit. That's different from the last Sunset, where they said we didn't need committees. They didn't say that this time. What they said was that if the commission decides to maintain the committees they have, they're going to have to clean it up and have some more defining language in the rules and such. So we'll address that however the commissioners see fit. The rest of the changes recommended dealt with the training that the commissioners received. They'd like to see some annual training for them. Reciprocity for other states. That could prove to be a challenge, but I don't think it's out of the question. It would be our staff working with the staff of other state fire commissions or whatever they might have to look at that. They think that we need a little more robust complaint tracking system, so that's something internally that we can work on and improve. And specifically, a more easy to find and clean complaint form, if you will, that would be available on the website. Those are things administratively that we can work on here. Let's see. Really, that was it. They want to clean up some reporting requirements that we have to the state that haven't been exercised in years and really aren't necessary. Clean up some of the statutory language that was directed more towards the legislature. And they do recommend that we review a little closer some of our rules covering criminal convictions, as well as just our overall rule review process. They indicate in their report that it could be a little more robust or a little more input, if you will, from the stakeholders and from the public. So I don't think there's anything outlandish. I can tell you that as a couple of you sitting in here, we've been through 3 or 4 of these in our lifetime. This is probably the best Sunset report that's come out on the agency in 30 years. So I was kind of refreshed by it. In particular, they start off their report with saying we need to continue. So that was a plus, and I think a compliment to everybody involved in it. I think we're doing some good work here. Maybe we could do a little better in a few areas. And that's certainly how we approach this with staff and with the Sunset Commission. We welcomed them in. I mean, it was a great opportunity to look at what we're doing and identify ways to do it better. And so I think they provided a little bit. I don't think any of it's outlandish. Some of it might involve some work, but I don't think any of it's impossible. I hope that answered your question, probably more than you wanted.
Anybody else have any questions? Any other future agenda items?
Okay. Item number 10, future meeting dates.
Deb, do you have the dates that the commission is meeting in 2021?
That's what I was fixing to ask. Because I have the 20, I have the 20, January 28th, and you said the 22nd, so.
It had to be changed.
Yeah, we had to change it.
So it's January 21st is their workshop. The 22nd is the actual commission meeting, and that'll be on a Friday instead of Thursday.
Okay. What are their other meeting dates?
April is 29th. Make sure I tell you right, I think I have them in my head, but let me see. April 29th.
I have July 15th.
That's a Friday also?
No, that's back to Thursday. The January is the only Friday one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
July 15th.
Their workshop in July is the 14th, and then July 15th is the actual commission meeting. And then October the 28th is the commission meeting.
That's what I have.
I think you have some dates for moving forward for all of next year. You guys are open to.
You have some penciled in for us then?
Yeah.
Well, why don't we just, why'd you make me wait for so long and ask all those stupid questions? I think I got set up here. Okay.
Okay, for your March meeting, it's either the 11th or the 18th.
Well, it might be hard to get a room up here because the 17th is St. Patrick's Day.
These are the dates that are for the room.
No, he's talking about hotel room.
Hotel room. I look at the 11th.
Which week is spring break if there even is one?
Like the 18th, he starts hitting around spring break.
Yeah.
Around here, it depends. The whole month of March, the second, third, fourth week are different schools for spring break.
Let's go to the 11th.
Yeah, I think the 11th might be a better date personally, but anybody else? 11th sound like a good date?
Sounds like a good date.
All right.
Okay, June is either June the 10th or June the 17th.
What was March? I'm sorry.
March 11th.
11th.
So June 10th or 17th?
10th.
I don't have a problem with the 10th. Does that look like a good date for everybody?
17th, I don't care. Either one.
Good.
10th?
Let's do June 10th.
Oh, I can't do the 6th.
10th.
I may not even be here.
The 10th?
I'm going to be Disney World.
This is better than Disney World.
I know.
You can't cancel those plans?
That's not what my 7 grandchildren say.
You and the Griswolds.
You wouldn't put your personal plans off for the Texas Fire Service?
Just for you, buddy.
Well, there we go. We have compliance.
What do you say?
I can do the 6th.
No, it's the 10th and the.
10th and the 17th.
17th.
Y'all pick them.
Can you do the 17th?
We're going to be gone over.
How about we go with the 10th and we give you a hall pass for going to Disney World?
There you go.
Just this once.
Just this once.
7 grandkids.
Got to bring us back something.
You might want to be here.
Probably will.
So what day?
June 10th.
Juneteenth?
10th.
June 10th.
Okay.
Okay. September the 9th or September the 16th?
16th.
My 16th.
September 16th?
Y'all saying the 16th?
16th. Good.
Works for me.
Works for me.
Yeah, that's fine.
And then December 2nd or December 9th?
Did you say 16th?
Go the 2nd. Can we do the 2nd?
Yeah, I think the earlier in the month, the better.
2nd?
Yeah.
Okay.
16th.
Does anybody have a huge heartburn about that?
And then December.
Okay.
December 2nd.
December 2nd.
Kind of puts it earlier in the month, so we have it logged down.
Starting 9 o'clock, Daniel?
Tim?
Yes, please.
No, let's set it for 9. Because we can always adjust that accordingly. We'll set them all for 9 a.m.
Oh, I get you.
But if we need to adjust it for some reason, we can do that before the public posting.
Okay.
Item 11, adjourned meeting.
I'll entertain a motion.
Motion.
Second.
Anderson seconded. Reedy made the motion. Okay, all those in favor? Any disapprove? Okay, motion is adjourned. Our meeting's adjourned.
Motion's adjourned. Turn your microphone.